Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of ProJock. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying and selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship the reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit TheReptileReport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit ShipReptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile-related.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python's forums, www.moreliapythons.com. Tonight, we have an awesome guest. We have Ryan Young from Molecular Reptiles joining us, and we're going to be talking about, Owen, I don't know how many different species he breeds, but
everything, pretty much. Like everything, everything. It's easier just to say everything. It'd be a shorter list to say what Ryan Young doesn't breed. Red-tailed boa?
Yeah.
Exactly. I'll have to ask him. He probably has a pair of those, too. I mean, you know, for all I know. And he's probably snakes. Successfully breeding them, yeah. So.
I'm excited to be talking to him and picking his brain on how he keeps and breeds some of the stuff that he's working with. Real quick, I am proud to announce that, as you heard in the beginning of the show, that we're joining forces with Chad and Robin over there at the Reptile Report, Ship Your Reptiles, the Reptile Marketplace. We're going to be bringing you a weekly segment focused on the reptile world called the Reptile Insider. We're going to be picking your guys' brains, you guys, the listeners, and trying to figure out maybe topics that you want them to hit on. But me, Owen, Chad, and Robin are going to be, you know, talking about different hot topics in the reptile world, breeding business, how you can promote yourself, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it should be very cool, and I'm very pleased to be working with those guys. They're top-notch, professional guys, and they do good stuff for the hobby, so it's awesome
stuff. The problem is that as a diehard Steelers fan, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to keep my cool around Chad Brown, just because, you know, that's one of the teams he played for. So if I am like a giggling idiot for the first couple episodes, I apologize to the people. So
yeah, it was today. Today I was talking with those guys, and it was pretty cool. It was pretty starstruck. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're talking to. I don't know. I always use the phrase rock stars, but you know, that's how I look at that. So yeah, it's going to be cool. I think it will be, you know, just one more thing to, you know, to keep the show cool and interesting, and you know, help those guys promote the marketplace, the Reptile Report, Ship Your Reptiles, and help. They're going to help us promote the show. So. It's a win-win, how I look at it. So.
Holy crap, people were important. Weird. So.
Well, I don't know if I go that far yet, Owen, but.
never mind. Sorry, it's already gone to my head. Damn it.
It's definitely
a very cool thing, and I'm glad we could work that out with them, because it's something else that adds to the show, and it adds to the Reptile Report. It's going to be cool. So.
Yeah, good stuff. Man, I'm just real quick, me personally, I'm like counting down the days.
Have they not hatched yet?
No, they haven't. I'm going nuts.
Are you freaking out? Are you freaking out yet?
Yeah, I'm looking.
When do you leave on vacation?
I leave Sunday. Sunday.
Oh, my God.
I hope they're hatched out by then. That would be like, I think day 53. Today's day 53, so I think it should be
okay.
Any day.
I have a clutch due the 22nd, and actually the 22nd is actually technically day 60. It's there, so I usually count it out too, because if we get past day 60 is when they're going to start tweaking out, so, we're right there.
I usually go by 55, but. I don't know. I figured that they would be pipping, and I keep going in there to look to see if I see a little albino head popping out, and you know.
If you're leaving on vacation and they haven't like fully hatched yet, are you gonna be nervous,
Rex? Oh my god, dude, I'm going nuts. Are you kidding me?
Why would you say that?
Oh man, you're gonna have to stay overnight at my house until they hatch.
It's easier just to bring them here, Jesus. But, I'd be tweaking. So.
And then I have a clutch. Now watch, this is how my luck will work out. I have a clutch hatching out when I get back. So they'll go early.
And the other they'll go early, late. These will go late. That's exactly par for that course. Yeah, come on now. Jesus.
So cool stuff. I just wanted to, before we bring Ryan on here, cause we'll be jumping into the good stuff in a couple of minutes. I just wanted to, give a shout out to our friends over at Green Tree Python Keeper Radio. They have a show tomorrow that you don't want to miss. It is Trooper Walsh will be joining them.
Holy crap.
Yeah. He's kind of an icon in the chondro world. And he's pretty much one of the guys that started it all. So it'll be interesting to hear his take on the whole thing. I know he gave a little bit of a talk at ICAST, and if you're into, like, you know, the history of it, which I think most Chondro people are, you know, you'll really enjoy that show. So, yeah, so go over and check it out, Green Tree Python Keeper Radio. It's definitely going to be worth a listen. Anything going on with you, Owen?
I got red tigers getting ready to hatch out here on the 22nd, so we're pretty much doing the same thing you are, just kind of checking out the eggs. But other than that, I mean, just waiting for babies. I did get Brettel's eggs. Was that Friday? I think. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But
yep.
I got that, so I've technically bred something else other than coastal carpet pythons now. Huzzah. But, yay! Still no IJs.
Yeah.
But we had a good time at Hamburg on Saturday. It was fun hanging out with everybody, and you know, you and
yeah.
I talked out most of the time and sold a few snakes, and you know, it was funny because you and I were like in the midst of talking, and then you got hit in the chest with a wet paper towel, won by Jason Balin. So
yeah.
You know, now you know, like, you know, he can hit you from around the room. So, and I'm drinking out of a Morelia Python Radio Frosty mug right now.
Oh yeah, there you go.
That was used, yeah. And then we did the birthday barbecue at my place so Saturday night, and I got hammered. I don't know about you, but I, you know.
Mm-mm. For
yeah.
once, you were hammered and I wasn't.
Yeah, it was the reverse.
Yeah.
Well, you weren't. Yeah, I live here, so I could just pass out. But you know,
yeah.
So it was fun. It was a good time, and now I'm looking forward to getting into the baby's hatching, so hopefully we'll get some more little worms with teeth running around here.
Yeah, and I guess we can announce that we will officially be at Tinley Park.
We can announce this because
yeah.
at this point, because I kept telling people, I'm going to go to Tinley Park, and everyone's like, cool, and then Jason Balin's like, I've heard this song and dance before, and he's like, I'll believe it when I see you there. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. I think he said he's heard it. He's heard this too much, and it hurts too, and it hurts every time. So he doesn't want to trust me. So
yeah.
I'm like, ah, oh, way to plunge it right in the heart. So I actually just went online and I booked my plane ticket because, like I said, my mom is getting married that Friday, so I will be unable to drive out with you, Zach, and whoever else is going in the mighty caravan of Morelia. But
right.
I'm going to send all my snakes and gear and stuff with you and then fly out and land, probably going to be leaving about 6 a.m. Philadelphia and then landing in Chicago at 7, take a cab and meet you over at Tinley Park. So I'll show up in a tuxedo if I have to. I'll look damn good. But, you know, we're going. we're doing Tinley. It's happening.
So yeah,
we will officially be there.
Be on the lookout for us. We'll be at Carpet Row representing. So,
yeah.
All stuff. So, I mean, I don't know if you have anything else to hit on, but I
got nothing.
All right, let's get Ryan on here and let's get this going. So, let's click him on there. Yeah, oh, real quick, if you have a question or any comments or anything that you want to talk to Ryan, feel free to call in. I'll throw the number out. I don't do that this often, but.
No, we don't. We don't really do that at all.
When we have guests with a lot of knowledge and
the
number is 347-215-7359. So feel free to drop a line in and, we'll get it going. So, Ryan Young.
Hey, what's going
on?
Show.
How you doing?
How's it going?
All right.
Good.
Awesome. So let's get started, Ryan. Let's get the good stuff out of the way. I know you're big into the outdoors and all that stuff, just by your Facebook page. But can you tell us about yourself a little bit and how you got started into reptiles?
Well, you know, it's probably a lot like everybody else. Started out liking animals as a kid and my parents were never super keen on reptiles, so I had a lot of small rodents, small animals, when I was younger. Was raising those, selling them back to the pet stores, and then I had a pretty good stint breeding parrots when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working at local pet stores and got the reptile bug, and went from there. But it's basically I had to get old enough to move out before I could have. I guess I had a few iguanas and stuff like that, but before I could have snakes. But I did have a rubber boa. That was the one thing I could convince my mother to let me have, was a fairly harmless looking rubber boa.
Yeah, really non-threatening a rubber boa is. So cool. So when you first were able to get into the reptiles or get your own, did it kind of like explode? Were you like knee deep in snakes before you knew it, or did you kind of like pick and choose?
No, I had always wanted a green tree python, and a wholesaler in Seattle had one on their list for a couple of years, where we were buying fish from. And so they put it on special one week, and I convinced my boss to let me buy it. So I drove over to Seattle and picked it up. So that was
wow.
Nice. That was my first python. I guess I'd had one ball python as a kid, but that was the first python that I'd gotten after I moved out. So,
well, that's a good pick, in my opinion. So,
yeah,
you've done well.
She was a great snake. Taught me a lot of stuff. So,
cool. So, tell us a little about Molecular Reptile, your company. What you're working with? What you're doing there?
I've been breeding stuff for quite a while. Previously I'd shared a site with other people, and that didn't work out. And then, so I'd been wholesaling a lot of stuff to people overseas, they started breeding a lot of their own stuff, so that was getting harder to do. So then I just decided, well, I should probably do a website and all that and come up with some kind of a name and go from there. So
mm-hmm.
I would say about a year ago, I came up with that name and a logo and everything, and still working on a website. So we'll get that going here pretty quick. But right now it's just what it is.
Hey, people can get by with less. I mean, come on now. So
you got to
get
the reptiles first, I guess. I've been more concerned with that.
Forget the website. Just get the reptiles and put a picture up on your Facebook. That's good enough. So,
well, it seems like everything's going to Facebook. So.
Yeah, that's one of our main concerns. So I'm kind of losing the forums to Facebook.
Yeah, it's a sad day for sure because the archives and all the past
mm-hmm.
conversations, the records on those forums are pretty invaluable, in my opinion.
Well, it's a shame. So you have a pretty impressive collection when it comes to the amount of species you work with. Can you give us just a quick overview of some of the species that you do work with, and which ones are your favorites, and which ones are the easiest to breed, and which ones are the more difficult?
Okay, I keep a big collection of ball pythons, obviously, quite a few blood pythons, Angolans, Womas, Blackheads, green tree pythons, all the Antaresa genus, or I guess all that are available in the States.
Mm-hmm.
What else? The Sawvus, Waters, Maclots, I have Timors. Oh, geez. Quite a bit of stuff. Well, as far as my favorite, I'm a homer. I'm a green tree python all the way. My second favorite is probably pygmy python and the entire Antaresa genus I really like. I've never kept Carinata yet, so I have a feeling if I do, they will rocket up my list to that top tier, but currently
they are
I don't have
one of
them.
My favorites.
So, but so yeah, that's a rough idea what I keep.
Okay.
What do you think?
Keep a lot of stuff that's off the beaten path, so that's cool and more power to you. But which ones are the easiest to breed, you think?
The Antaresis genius is real easy.
Damn, then I suck because I can never get my spotted pythons to breed. So, you know, clearly I was
Man,
doing something wrong.
I have a children's python that I've had since I think like 1999, and I think she's laid every year since 2001.
Jesus! Wow! Let me figure that one out.
She's a good snake. Yeah, ball pythons are fairly easy to breed. Most of the stuff, I don't know, it seems, if you get captive bred stuff and raise it up yourself, most of these things seem relatively, no, I don't know if easy is the right word or hard is the right word, but if you can give them what they need and get out of their way, they usually will do what they're going to do. So.
Right. So which one would be, in your opinion, the more difficult? I know you mentioned a few species there, like Timor, who I know for a fact are considered extremely difficult to breed.
I've never actually had an adult pair. I've had Timors. This is my third venture into them.
Okay.
They're one of my, I think they're one of the most visually stunning pythons.
They are gorgeous.
But they are also one of the most disgusting pythons to keep, I guess. I don't know how else to say it. If you keep indigo snakes, you would probably love Timor pythons, but I'm not into big giant clivers that crap all the time, so Timor pythons to me are they're a beautiful looking snake, but somewhat frustrating to keep as far as their flighty behavior and their willingness to pee all over you. So, but like I said, it's hard for me because I genuinely believe that's one of the most beautiful pythons. But
yeah, their head scales are just amazing. They're like outlined in, I guess it's outlined in black or, oh man, it's just crazy.
Yeah, the last pair that I own.
Mac. So, you know.
The last pair that I owned before the pair I have now, I sold to a guy and he bred them. So.
Oh, damn it.
Oh, man.
So I had them for a couple years and I just couldn't handle it. That's just like it.
So. Oh, but that's really bittersweet. It's like, get out of here. I can't handle you. Yeah, I got eggs. Damn it. So, I mean,
I was very happy for him. Actually, I ended up getting a pair of the babies, and then I still couldn't handle it. So.
There you go.
So I guess I'm on my fourth venture into them.
What made this time different, do you think?
I'm just going to gut it out until I do it, and then I can part them.
Well, gotcha. Raise them up from babies, you should have a better shot because they got almost their entire lives to, or at least until they're sexually mature, to get acclimated to how you're doing stuff. So,
yeah, no, they're real. I mean, they're easy to keep as far as they're not particularly challenging. You know, they eat, they thrive, they just have a tendency to unleash themselves upon you. And it's
cool.
Somewhat frustrating.
Oh man, I can imagine. So yeah, you talked about chondros being your favorite, so let's talk some chondros. What are you working with? I know that you're known for your arus. Are you a locality guy, or
I'm a diehard locality guy.
All right.
And the only thing I keep right now are arus. I've had luminas and canaries and biox and all that stuff. I've bred all those things and sarongs. But I decided a few years back that I always liked arus, and everybody had always said, you can't breed high-wide arus, and I just didn't buy it. So I set out to prove you could.
Oh, Nothing like a little challenge. Now, you're talking about that, and you're a ruse. There's some, I mean, there's standouts when it comes to white, the white on them. What are your thoughts on what's going on with that genetically, and why does it seem difficult for people to reproduce that in captivity?
I think the biggest thing is people don't breed related animals, so they take wild-caught snakes, they breed them together, and they, for whatever reason, that first generation just does not seem to transpire. Despite how good the adults look, it just, for whatever reason, doesn't work. And so I always thought, I looked at the history, and I never saw anybody raise those up and breed those animals together. And I just thought, you know what, that's the ticket. So I got some rather, they were good looking for captive bred, but they weren't extremely high white, and but they were from extremely high white parents, and the first time I bred them together, I got really nice white babies. So
huh.
Didn't seem to be that big of a rocket science deal to me, but it's,
wow, that's cool. Are you trying to refine that, what, into a stripe, or just what are you trying to do with that?
Well, just as much white as possible. The funny thing, I produced a snake in 2010 that, you know, I would be hard pressed to have anybody show me a captive bred one with more white than her. But her sister is less white. But dare I say I like her look better. The green is a little different and the blue shows up more. So it's there's plenty of ways to go if you like, you know, nice white but a lot of blue, or if you like dark green, light green. I mean, there's a million ways to steer it. So just do what you like and keep going with it.
Right. Very cool. So are you doing anything special when it comes to husbandry? I know you keep them quite, well, you keep them the way they're supposed to be kept as far as size and whatnot, but, you know, anything special you do when it comes to husbandry?
Compared to most people, I guess I don't treat them very good.
That's it.
I don't really put them on a pedestal anymore, and I've noticed since then it seems like they thrive better. Biggest things I don't do is I don't give them any supplemental heat. I heat the room, and I don't heat the cages. A lot of people don't do that. But I mainly feed them mice. It's not that I feel rats are, like, the rat as far as the food item is a bad food item. I just think that rats are, for an appropriate sized rat to feed to a green tree python, is a immature rat, and I think I would take a mature prey item over an immature prey item any day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you can get away with things more with mice, feeding them mice than rats, as far as if you feed them mice, they digest it quicker, not because there's, but because just the mass, a rat of the same size as a mouse is a bigger item. And that's what dictates how long it takes them to digest it, I don't believe the prey species has much to do with it.
Okay. So when you go with the ambient room temperature, is there a temperature that you're trying to hit?
They seem to be most comfortable between 80 and 82. Now, in the summertime, my room will get up to 85, the room temperature, during the late afternoon, and they don't have any ill effects from that. And it gets back down to 78, 80 at night.
Okay.
But they go through that heat with no, they don't coil loosely or act uncomfortable or anything.
Now, do you do any of the typical, like, misting or any of that kind of stuff that conjurers are all certain of? No problems with shedding?
I have a few turtles in my snake room, so my humidity is relatively high compared to, I don't know exactly what it is, but I know it's higher than it was when I didn't have the turtles.
Right.
When I didn't have the turtles, I keep them in ZooMed glass tanks with a screen top. And when they were in shed, before I had the turtles, I would put a piece of paper over the screen top, and then I would just pour water on the bottom of the cage to raise the humidity. But I never sprayed them. They don't act like they enjoy being sprayed. And I always just thought, well, it just makes water spots all over everything, and they don't act like they enjoy it, so.
Right.
They will go drink from a bowl, and that's how I do it, so.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I think the problem I see with most, the way people keep these guys, is they use a heat panel that's, you know, usually almost half the size of the lid of the cage. And I believe that they create basically a dehumidification chamber in their cage, and it is constantly drying everything out. And I don't believe – I've kept them every way you could possibly imagine. And I used to have heat panels like everybody else, off of the hot spot, off of the cool spot. And I noticed that they always spent 100% of their time as far away from the heat panel as they possibly could get. And I would say probably, I don't know, at least 8 years ago, no, maybe not 8 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, I had moved some snakes from one room to another, and I failed to plug their heat panels in. And I was like, man, my green tree pythons are using way more of their cage than they ever have in the past. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. And I finally realized, wow, their heat panel's been off for 3 weeks, and you know, they're acting like they enjoy things, and they never did that tail hanging behavior. They were always tightly coiled, and they were using areas of their cage that I had never witnessed them use before. And so those were some of the reasons that made me think, huh, maybe these things don't like, you know, hot spots per se, like we want to give them. And
right.
I also noticed that back in the day I would have, when I was using heat panels, that they would get, their spine would be really dry and the scales would almost kind of get crinkly along the spine, right behind the head, and down a couple inches, right at the neck, and that's where the stuck shed would always happen. And I noticed within, I don't know, 6-8 months of not using heat panels, that every chondro that I had kept with a heat panel, that went away. And those scales appeared to get flatter again and more normal looking. And so I just figured, well, that's the way to do it.
That's awesome. So do you, just on a side note, do you keep any other species that way or just chondros?
I pretty much don't give anything a basking spot other than the Anchoresa.
Oh, okay.
So I just use the ambient temperatures for everything.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Now, when it comes to chondro size, I was reading when I was doing some research for the show, I was looking at some of your old post on the MVF, and there was a post about the Wilson papers and the chondro size, and you said that, I remember when these papers, the Wilson papers came out, it made me question everything I was doing with my snakes and changed how I do things. Can you elaborate on that? And what was it that made you?
The biggest thing about the Wilson papers were, for one, it showed without question that this is a truly small snake, and they should not get anywhere near as big as the literature at the time was pressing. And I'm very grateful that in the early days of me keeping green tree pythons, I never had a scale available to me. So I didn't know that my original female chondro that I knew was an adult, I didn't realize that she was only 750-800 grams. So I'm very grateful that I didn't have a scale, or I would have fed the shit out of her and probably killed her. So. I didn't know how big they were. I just kind of looked at them and looked at how big their eggs were and how old they were, and just treated them like they were adults when I felt like they were adults. And it turned out once I did get a scale that most of the ones I had were anywhere from 725 to 850 was most of my typical adult females, and I thought they were huge, but apparently some of you East Coasters grow them even bigger over there.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that. Do you think that that's what causes the issues we see in captivity with chondros?
I mean, I don't think any single one thing you can say that's what causes all the issues. But I think if you look at obesity and what it does to every other animal, I don't know why you would expect snakes to be able to be any different. So.
Okay.
But as far as a lot of the stuff with green trees, I think when you give them a huge basking spot, they try to avoid it, and that you're basically making their cage smaller by making most of it unusable for what they're after. And then you overfeed them, which does not promote movement. But the biggest things, like the Wilson papers, that I took away from them was how little these things actually eat and how active they were looking to eat. And so
right.
What the biggest thing the Wilson papers made me rethink was how I feed them. And clearly I wasn't feeding them as much as other people were, but I still had lazy chondros that tail hung occasionally and didn't defecate very often. And so I decided after reading the Wilson papers that my interpretation of those papers was the thing that causes a green tree python to move was its search for food. And so even if it's just, you know, crawling down, staring at the ground, and then crawling back up to wherever they, you know, I don't know how high up they crawl. I don't even know if anybody knows that for sure, but they clearly move from the ground to at least somewhat off the ground every day in search of food. So I decided I was going to take one of my males and I was going to refuse to feed him until he crawled around and showed me how hungry he was. And I think he didn't move for, what do I want to say? I looked at him every night and I don't think he moved for a month and a half, something like that. And then just like on cue, he took a dump and started crawling. And I mean, I don't have him in big cages, and he was all over the cage, under the paper, over the branches, all over the cage.
Right.
And I was like, wow, he's moving. And so I went out there the next night, and sure enough, he was back at it. And every night he was acting that way. And so I said, okay. After five nights, I fed him a relatively small meal for how big he was. And he ate it, and then he didn't move for 2 days. And the third day, he started moving again, and he defecated again, like on the fourth day. And it was, I mean, you would have thought a baby green tree python was in the cage. And I was like, wow, you know, I think that was a very eye-opening deal for me. I've looked at that, and I said, you know, a green tree python in the wild can't crawl around full of crap. It's just not, it doesn't make any sense. And activity seems to be linked to the defecation, and not just snakes, but, I mean, even human beings. So it started to dawn on me that I personally believe the biggest contributing factor to prolapse is that, for one, the snakes aren't using very much of their muscles all the time because they're sitting way too much, and two, they're so full of crap, they're trying to take turds that they would never build up that much fecal material before defecation in the wild. And so it started to dawn on me that if you can increase the activity level, you'll increase the bowel movements and you'll decrease the size of the bowel movements and you won't have any issues. And since I've been imploring that feeding schedule, I mean, it's not a schedule, it's, you let them dictate to you, and it changes. If you feed them a big meal, they won't move. If you feed them a small meal, they move more often. So I've told people, you can feed a green tree python as much as you want if you just you know, drop the food size to an insultingly. If you're a person that has to feed your snake all the time, and I get why you need to do that, because when I first got my first green tree pies, and I, you know, the only communication I guess I had with the snake for it showing me that it was happy was that it would eat, and
right.
So I get why people overfeed them.
Yeah.
So I've done tons of playing around with it, and you can feed these things like every 4 or 5 days if you feed them a tiny meal. If you feed them a big meal, then you just have to adjust it based on their behavior, not based on a schedule. Is the worst thing that ever happened to a snake. The human condition, snakes don't understand schedules.
Right.
And so
that
we
makes sense.
I think so for me, feeding them based on their behavior is the most important factor to them keeping them successfully.
Okay. Wow, that's great.
If you make them, they'll show you all their behavior, and they're insanely active snakes if you let them be. But
right.
If you have to feed them all the time and you have to feed them big meals, then they're going to sit there and look pretty. But they're not going to display their lean, mean cruising machines.
Right. I do have a question when it comes to your the ambient temperature and breeding. What is the cue then for them to breed? Like, what do you have them breed throughout the year?
No, I mean I do. I still cycle like other people. I still drop my temperatures in the wintertime. But
oh, okay.
I don't offer basking spots until they've ovulated.
Okay, and you don't run
so
into
I
see
still,
like when. When I did that, I had troubles with respiratory infections, but I noticed when I gave them a bath, not chondros, we're talking carpets now, but actually eryngitis, so it's, I guess it's somewhat similar, same continent. Do you see respiratory infections at all with not offering a basking spot, or do you just not... You drop it a little bit, or what's your approach?
I think the key is you can't cycle hard without
okay.
the it's all a give and take. If you cycle hard, then you have to make up for it with higher basking spots. So if I usually cycle to 72 is the lowest I go, and I only do that for a couple weeks. It's usually 74 most of the time.
Okay.
And I up the and I guess I do increase the daytime temperature in the winter to 82 from 80 the rest of the year.
Okay.
But like I said, in the summer it will get warm. It'll still get down to 78, 80 at night, but it'll get as hot as 85 for a few hours in the afternoon.
Okay. Awesome.
But I kept Darwin carpets, jungle carpets, Arians, and Redline. None of them have basking spots. So I don't have any issues, but I don't feed big meals. So it's not a one. I think a lot of people get fixated on the temperature, but they don't change other things. If you want to feed big meals and cycle them hard, then you got to give them basking spots. If you want to feed
right.
them small meals and not cycle them hard, then you can treat them like I do. But I think that's where people get into trouble with whatever method you want to call it. It's a whole entire system of keeping stuff, not just, you can't just change one thing and expect everything else to fall in line.
Right. Huh. Interesting. Okay.
And I think the snakes themselves, too. Most of the snakes I keep, I've got when they were little, and they've, in essence, grown up in this system. I rarely ever get adults from other people. So.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. That was one thing that me and Omen were talking about this weekend. I've noticed that whenever I have gotten adults, that I have troubles with them. And I'm assuming that it's because they're used to a certain regimen, and I'm not giving them that regimen, and they're having a hard time adjusting to what I'm giving them. And I don't know, I've tried to steer clear of adults.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. They, they get acclimated to doing things a certain way, and then if you drastically change, I think adults stress out harder than babies during transit and stuff like that, and then different,
right.
You know, if they've lived one way for 10 years or 5 years, and then they're, you know, forced to live a different way, I think, you know, I guess if you took somebody from Alaska and or somebody from Texas and dropped them in Alaska, you know, they'd probably get cold too. You know, they're not used to it. So.
Goddamn common sense. Wow.
Yeah, well. None.
Oh, man, he dropped the common sense on us, Owen.
Yeah, well, I know.
Sometimes it's, you know, the answer staring you in the face is usually the right one. So.
Yeah.
The simplest explanation.
Gotcha.
Good to know.
But, so that's how I do green trees. I don't, you know, I do offer them a basking spot once they're gravid, and I found the last three clutches I've had, the females didn't even look at it. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'll keep that in mind in a couple of years when I can actually try. So, on to another species you work with, white-lip pythons. I know you had success this year with the black-faced white-lips, which congratulations, and I am extremely jealous of you and your little clutch of black-faced white-lips. can you walk us through a little bit of your approach to the species, the husbandry, how you did introductions, and where you think you kind of went right?
Okay. Well, I got the female, I think in 2006, and she was pretty small, but she was an imported female. I got the male in 2009, I think. He was captive bred. And the biggest thing, I've had many conversations with the barkers, and they've talked quite often with ring pythons and white lips that apparently they're relatively mate selective. If you put a pair together and they hang out, then you're probably doing pretty good. If you put a pair together and they spend all their time away from each other, then you're probably not going to do very good. So that was my number one concern, was that I hope that they just like each other. So
yeah.
I think I can't remember when did I first. I think I first tried pairing them up 4 seasons ago. And I was, to be honest with you, the first season I paired them up, I was just happy that they hung out and they bred and they copulated. I saw them copulate quite a bit, so I was like, wow. So quickly my aspirations from I hope they just like each other rapidly turned to, wow, I hope I get eggs. So needless to say, it didn't happen. She swole up huge with follicles, just never ovulated. But the funny thing was she had started developing follicles. I think that's the reason I first put them together, was I could tell she was, like, getting fat, and I wasn't feeding her anymore. So that's when I decided to try pairing them up. The only problem was it was, like, August. And she started developing follicles, got really huge, had the biggest follicles I've ever seen. I mean, I thought, oh, my God, those are eggs. And then she went into shed and never laid anything. So, but my deal, I start cycling my snakes October 1st every year, no matter what. And I think she started developing in August, and then I think when I started cycling the room, it's messed her up. So
okay.
I was crushed and bummed, like you would expect. And so the next season, I, you know, high hopes again, and the same thing. This time, instead of August, she started cycling in, like, September. And the same thing. As soon as I started cycling the room, she acted like that just, you know, was not what she wanted. And so then it was, I think, the following year, I don't think she cycled at all. I think I put them together a little bit and never saw anything. And then last year, was the first year that her cycle happened when it corresponded with how I cycle my snakes. So I think it just was a matter of, you know, getting her in sync with what I was doing. And so I think my consistency of cycling October 1st, you know, finally got her on the same schedule as me. And it just, I mean, I wish I had some great, grandiose proclamation I could make about what you have to do to breed them, but all I can say was I really didn't change a whole lot. And when her timing and my timing seemed to mesh, then everything went smooth, and she laid 9 perfect eggs, and there's 9 perfect babies out there. So
that's fantastic. So hopefully you have continued success with them. I mean, I know you recently got into the Golds as well, so hopefully you get success with them too.
I've never had an adult pair of Golds. I've had adult females and adult males, but never an adult pair at the same time. So.
that's good. I mean, do you find easier to work with, the Golds or the Blacks?
I would say, I guess typically the Blacks are a little easier to work with based on they're not quite as aggro. But I guess I'm somewhat lucky. My pair of Golds are very, when you open their tub, they want to eat. And
yes.
Once you hook them and get them out, both of them are extremely tractable and don't try to bite you anymore.
You got lucky.
Yeah, well, I've had quite a few, so I understand that. I'm very lucky that they're both like that.
Jeez.
And I think part of that's they're both fairly, they're not small snakes either. And I think a lot of the white lips and rings and a lot of these things, even carpets, you know, pretty high strung when they're little. And if you go past that, then usually you got a fairly tractable adult. But they, you know, they want to eat first. That's always, you know, I don't feed very much. So when I open that tub, they first thing on their mind is it's
very, very cool. So
they come ready to go.
Yeah, they do. Have you noticed any? I know you were talking about compatibility and pairing. When we were pairing our white lips this year, a pair of our black faces actually injured each other because they were just that uncompatible. Was that something you were a little afraid of?
I'd heard about that with rings and gold white lips, so I was concerned about that up until once I had put them together, and they never showed even the remote bit of animosity towards each other. I was unconcerned about it after that. So.
Okay.
Because from what I've heard, it usually, if it's going to happen, it happens, you know, on the first introduction. I don't know if that was your experience, but
we put them together and they kind of weren't anywhere near each other in the cage, but they weren't necessarily bothering each other or getting upset with each other. And then there was some thudding around, but they kind of stopped, and then they were curled up and nipped together. But then the next day we had full-on bites and wraps, and we had a bunch of scrapes and cuts, and some damage was done, but everybody healed. So
yeah.
nothing too gruesome, but enough for us to decide that pair was going to not
I would say more than likely, though, that pair is never, you're probably never going to accomplish anything with them, with each other anyway.
Yeah, luckily we got other boys, so we can just try again. So,
well, that's good. I was lucky. I only had the one pair, so.
Yes.
Well, like I said, that was my first concern, was that they liked each other, and they definitely seemed to. Getting
awesome.
Them to lock up was never an issue.
Well, you got a great pair there, so that's awesome.
Well, I think one thing, my female's a wild caught, and she's very, very mellow, where my male is captive bred, and he's not mean, but he... you know, you have to keep both eyes open when you're playing with him. And,
I will agree with that because we have the same situation with our females. All our females are wild caught, and all our males are captive-breds, and the males are twitchier than the boys.
Yeah, so I definitely think that I was grateful. My female seems extremely mellow, and I don't know if that is why they get along, because he's jumpy and she's mellow. If she was jumpy and he was jumpy, then I might have problems. But
I get it. You got to kind of keep the mellow with the jumpy. Okay, cool. So
who knows? We'll see. Hopefully they'll. I don't know if I'll try again next year. I usually let everything have a year off, but we'll see. If
hopefully
she's acting up
success.
To it. Yeah. I tried to do that with Fuscus, but you can't seem to stop them from breeding. So.
Yeah, that's what I hear. So, let's move on to another species that you work with. That's Liasses. I know you said you have Waters, the Savus, and Max, which
yep.
I totally dig the Liasses. And I think the only thing I'm missing right now is I got to pair up my water python. So could you kind
of
go
through?
You
need a pair of water pythons, or you have a pair of water pythons?
I have a male. I have one lone
oh, okay.
male. And actually, you produced the male.
Oh, there you go. Well,
yeah,
I have a lone female right now, baby.
God damn it. Damn it. You people are going to make me feel damn broke. All these people
that
are showing up out of the woodwork all bringing me animals. I know.
So, I'm not trying to tell you something. But
I'll talk to you later. But,
all right.
I'm really digging the – I think I'll see. I think you No, I think Kyogen produced my olives. Never mind. But they're definitely, I believe, an underrated species. Can you run through your experiences with them, keeping and of course, breeding them? Because I know you had success. I think you had a clutch of Savu right now, correct?
Yeah. I got Savu eggs cooking, and I hatched my water pythons and my macaws already.
Man.
But I don't. Those are the three species I've kept from the genus. I've had all the pythons for a few months, but I never kept them for very long, so I can't really go too crazy into breeding all the pythons. But the Macaulay and the Fuscus are, you know, fairly straightforward to breed. They breed just like the carpet pythons during the winter, lay in the spring. The Savus don't breed in the winter. They breed in the spring, so they're always a little later than the other things. But they, typical, you know, I don't, like I said, I keep them in CV70s and don't give them any heat until they're gravid. So start pairing them up in, this, you know, usually November. And they usually are very willing breeders, and as soon as I stop cycling, they usually ovulate. And most of the time, the Macaulay and the Fuscus are some of the first clutches of the year, and the Savu is usually one of the last.
Okay.
Wow.
So
I think most people make mistakes with Savus because they try to breed them like everything else, and in my experience, they don't. And food cycling appears to be a big thing with Savus.
So what temps do you normally, how low do you think that the Liasses normally get, and when or how do you food cycle the Savus?
Basically, I don't feed the Savus all winter. And then as soon as I warm up, I start feeding them quite a bit. But I feed them mice, so I keep the meals small, so I can get away with feeding them a lot but not, you know, overdoing it. And as soon as the temperatures warm back up and they start getting that food, they're usually all over each other, and then they do their thing. So,
cool.
But I think if you keep them hot, if you give them a basking spot, in my experience, anyways, listen, other people keep them basking spots and do fine. But in my experience, when I keep them with no basking spot, and as soon as I warm up from cycling the room, then they start eating. I start putting them together, and they usually, you know, ovulate a couple months later, and then I give them the heat.
Cool.
But
so
like I said, I do everything like that, every species I have. So
everything's drawn the pretty much the same way. It's just
if it's a species I think needs a little cooler, I'll keep them lower in the room just because the concrete floor can make it get a little bit cooler. But usually the coldest anything can get in my room is 70, 72.
Okay. So who's the only ones that you food cycle, or do you kind of food cycle everybody?
I mean, I food cycle everybody to some extent, and I mainly I don't feed much during the summertime because I'm usually feeding all the, you know, I only have X amount of money to buy food with. I do breed my own rodents. I don't have enough rats, so I do buy rats, but so I usually feed. I focus on feeding all the babies during the summer, and then when I start cycling, I usually start feeding the adults heavy again.
Cool. So, do you have any kind of a different approach to the Mac lots? Because I know I got several locks from my Macs this year, but to no avail. And out of the Liasis species, which one do you think is kind of the more docile of them, as opposed to the ones who are a little bit more edgy? Kind of like, where would you think someone just getting the Liasis should begin?
To be honest with you, I think they're all, I mean, really about the same. Most of them, as even Favus as babies, can be nasty little things. but usually are, you know, within, if you don't let that bother you, they get over that relatively quickly. And the water pythons are the same way. They're usually little terrors. But my adult water pythons are some of the most mellow, trustworthy snakes. I mean, my 9-year-old daughter plays with them. You know, they don't offer any kind of, aggression at all. Once they realize you're not feeding them. But the Maculidae are, they're the same way. The best babies are usually pretty feisty. My adult female is, you know, you can handle her. She won't bite you, but, you know, same thing. You gotta, when you're getting her out, she's gotta know you're not feeding her. But I would say out of the ones I have, I trust the Macs the least. Just, and it might be more because I just haven't messed with them as much. The Fuscus, I'd always heard were a really nasty species. So when I had the baby Fuscus for the first time, I really, really handled them a lot. And so it has paid off. It's paid off. My adults are really mellow. But the Max, I don't think I gave them as much effort, so they're a little more, probably more my female. My male, I mean, he's not much bigger than the spotted python, but he's real mellow. He's never shown any aggression since he's not been a baby anyways.
Cool. Now, have you ever heard of a Liasis getting hooked onto a certain type of food? Because I have a Maculidus python who will only eat chicken, chicks mainly, maybe a little bit older than chicks. Don't know where he got hooked on it, never was offered chicks until he got to me and wouldn't eat for almost half a year, I think. So offered him chicks and he just rolled right onto it and never gave him up, will not look at a rodent. You ever kind of heard anything like that going on?
Not with Maculidae. I would say Maculidae are usually the most interested in eating anything. So I've never heard of it with Maculidae. I can definitely tell you that the Fuscus that I've kept, they seem to prefer rats to mice at a fairly early age than the other stuff. The Savus, they usually eat anything you put in the cage, so I don't, I've never heard problems with them. I know, baby, olive pythons tend to prefer birds, but that's just what I've heard from other people, and I had one that wanted to eat birds, but usually once they start eating, you know, they usually eat just about anything, but in my experience, I would say that the Fuscus are the most food.
Eric's eating a broken Maculidus.
So
I think your problem is you actually give it what it wants. So
yeah, I you know what? I am in this. I'm very much in the school of I don't really care as long as you're eating and growing and are healthy. You can have whatever the hell you want. So
yeah.
Plus six.
I have one snake like that, so I feel your pain. I have a wild-caught teen-egg albino blood python, and that thing will not eat a rat. It'll eat anything else but a rat.
That sucks.
It'll eat guinea pigs, hamsters, gerbils, African soft bird, rats, mice, birds, rabbits, but it will not touch a rat.
Right, because rats are the easiest ones to get, and, you know.
Yep, I was able to get it to eat a rat one time. It took about a half hour of squeezing its tail as hard as I could while I beat the tar out of it with the rat till it got mad. But
yeah,
I just decided
that
I wasn't going to do
that
every 5 weeks. So now I just feed it African soft bird rats and, you know, small
rats. All in a day.
All in a day. So, let's talk a little bit about tannin bars. You were one of the, I think you said you were the third, right? Third person?
The fourth person. Fourth person,
fourth.
I believe.
Still good in my book. I mean,
I was first to breed captive bred, but I was the fourth to breed the species.
Okay. So tell us a little about the story and what was it like producing them, and, you know, what do you think led to your success?
Well, I wish I'd been more successful. I still think of that snake in my heart of hearts as overall it was still a failure. I was able to produce four of them, but that was it. So I don't have a glowing record with them. But I would say the main contribution to my failure was that was back when I kept stuff with too much heat and tried to treat them like everything else. And if I had to do it over again, I have a feeling I could do a little bit better. But
right.
I think with amethystine complex, they really want to bask when they're grabbing. And it's a case where I believe the snakes don't know what's best for them. And the biggest reason is Mother Nature takes away your basking spot every day. And
right.
So the snake doesn't have a I'm basking too much trigger, I don't believe. So they become incessant baskers. They turn black and they want heat. And I believe that a lot of the times when they slug or mostly slug out, it's because they ovulate prematurely. They ovulate before the ovum are fully developed. And part of my conclusion with that is I've been with people who've ultrasounded snakes. I've ultrasounded a lot of blood pythons. I don't own an ultrasound machine, but I've been with people who've done it. And not all of the follicles are the same size at any given time. And based on talking with people that use ultrasounds extensively, their opinion pretty much across the board is that, well, for one, you have two ovaries, and they don't always, all the eggs don't mature at the same rate. And if you give a snake too much heat at the wrong time, you can cause them, in my opinion, to ovulate prematurely. And that's why a lot of times you'll get clutches where you have some good eggs and some slugs or half slugs. You know, everybody's seen those nipple eggs. Well, it's like half that egg is mature, but the other half isn't. And I don't blame the male for slugs. I blame myself, but that's me. So,
keeper arrow. Okay.
So I believe that's when I bred the Nauta, she laid four perfect eggs and a bunch of duds. And I think it was just she ovulated too quick, and only four were fully mature. And that's that.
Okay.
I have a funny Nauta story. I heard you talking about going on vacation with your clutch due to hatch.
Yeah.
I was so crazy about my Nauticlus that I was headed to Texas when they were due to hatch, and I packed them up and took them with me.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
Eric, how pissed would your wife be if you did that?
Just put them in the car?
That's
how
what
did
I did. I took,
yeah.
I took a cooler, and I took an AC or a converter, power converter for a car, and I made a little traveling incubator, and I stuck them in there, put the Helix thermostat on it, and put it in the car and took them with me.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
2,000
awesome.
Miles.
Holy crap.
That's
they
fantastic.
Went from North Idaho to Central Texas to hatch.
And they hatched out fine. Wow.
Yeah, they hatched out the day after I got there.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of a fun experience because the female was produced by Dave and Tracy from the first ever breeding. And
okay.
They hatched out in Tracy's incubator, so it was pretty funny.
That's great. Cool.
That's funny as hell.
I do have a question on Tannin Bars from Rob Stone. And,
okay.
He wants to know, what are your thoughts on Tannin Bar genetics? What results did you get and others get that makes you feel, I guess you feel confident that both pattern and color are simple recessive rather than polygenic, including the intermediate patterned animals?
Okay. Well, the one, at the time that I hatched my clutch, it was the first clutch from F1 babies where you knew what the adults were. So the female was a patterned exantic. So it was a silver patterned snake. Her father was a patternless exantic, and her mother was a patterned exantic. And I believe, was it the whole clutch or part of the clutch? I think part of that clutch had some of each, but they were all exantic. So that pretty much it was confident at that point that exantic was a recessive trait because you bred an exantic to an exantic, you got all exantic. And you bred a pattern to a patternless, and you had to assume that the pattern was het for patternless, and I think she got roughly 50-50. It was either the one wasn't a het or was a het. I can't remember all the exact details, but anyways, I knew my female was het for patternless.
Okay.
One of her parents was patternless. So the male I got was a gold patternless animal that Nick had produced, and its mother was gold patternless, and its father was silver. Silver patterned, I think. Man, this is way back machine. So anyways, we knew what they should have been, and I hatched four babies, and I hatched one of each. So I mean, it's not a huge sample size, but exantic, you know, has proven to be recessive trait in every other species, and patternless is usually a recessive trait. So given we knew what the parents of mine were and what the results were, it was a fairly safe assumption that that's what they were. Now, as far as the intermediate phases, I think what you have is just varying degrees of the same thing. A lot of the patternless animals appear to be somewhat striped, and I don't know, and part of me wonders if are they patternless? Was that even the right thing to call them, or are they somewhat striped versus banded? It's really hard to say, but as far as I know, the striped ones breed out like patternless ones. That's the same thing, but I don't know for 100% sure about that. But so I believe the ancestral form is a gold patterned snake. Why the double recessive seems to be the most common snake that was coming in, it might be they're just easier to find, or that if you could fast forward long enough, that's what a Tannin Bar python would be. We just happen to live in a time where there's still some of the others left, and so we see all four phases. But
right.
There clearly seems to be some environmental pressure that is leading them to become, or at least a good percentage of them to become patternless, and exanthic.
Gotcha.
And if they are both recessive traits, if the whole entire population became the double recessive, it would in turn default become the normal. You couldn't go back. So
right.
It's just we're evolution in
right stuck before our eyes, right?
Well, yeah. 10,000 years from now, they might all be patternless and exanthic. Who knows? And
right.
So it's hard to say. But, or it might just be the collectors find those easier. And if they're really not, you know, whether in the wild that's that the exanthic patternless is the dominant form or not, it's hard to say.
Right. Now, he does have a follow-up to that. Can you do exanthic Tanabar babies show at birth, or can you only distinguish with size and age?
All of mine were red. You could tell the, I believe with before the first shed, you could start to see some of the pattern coming through, but you couldn't tell. I'm trying to think when. You could tell that the one was a gold pattern male, I would say within probably 4 months. After a couple of sheds, you could kind of get the idea that he was going to be gold instead of silver.
Okay.
And the same thing with the gold patternless one.
Okay. Very
but
cool.
No, right when they were born, you couldn't. They were all looked identical.
Cool.
Okay.
But the pattern, you could tell fairly quickly. Maybe even before the first shed. But.
Really?
Okay. Man, I have to try with our cannon bars. I want to get those babies now, all the different kinds.
That was a while ago, man. That was 2004.
I know, but, you know. We're
wow,
over
10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. we get our first crack at tannin bars next season, so I'm excited for that one. But, yeah.
Well, if you're a basking spot guy, I would encourage you to put your hide box on the other side of the cage, and then hopefully they'll just go in there and not come out.
I will write that down, and I will do that. So.
And I would turn that basking spot off at night, no matter how much she acts like she wants it. So.
Okay.
That would be, if I had to do it over again, I would.
Do it that way?
I would keep, for one, I would keep the female a lot smaller than mine was. But I didn't raise my female, so.
Yeah, now that you're wee, so. Yeah.
I would keep her a lot smaller, and I would, I'd food cycle them, and I would keep that heat away.
Okay. Cool. Well, I'll let you know if we get success.
All right.
Now, I know you mentioned a few times the Timors.
Yep.
And this species is such an incredible-looking python, but they're not that popular. Can you talk about kind of like having a love-hate relationship with these guys and kind of share some of your experiences? You know, I know we've been talking about it a few times. But they seem to be catching on, in my opinion. I know of a few breeders that are using this kind of side project to get into. Do you see that maybe picking up some speed?
I mean, you know, they used to be really popular. A lot of people liked them, but like a lot of things, they kind of fell to the wayside. So I think, in my opinion, like I said, they're one of the most beautiful pythons to look at, but they don't really handle like a python, I guess, or a typical, you know, they want to pee and flee, so to speak, and they just don't handle well. And one of the things for me personally I like about pythons is that they handle well for a snake. They're not usually always trying to run away, and that's the big drawback with Timors. Not only do they try to run away, but they piss and shit all over you. So
Yeah, I wouldn't like that, yeah.
So, that is my love-hate relationship with them. I love the way they look, but I don't like the way they behave. So. But I think, you know, there's a lot of people that like big colubrid-type snakes, and those people would probably love Timors. if you can handle an indigo or a Cuban boa or something like that, you should think a Timor python's marvelous.
So,
I couldn't keep Puerto Rican boas or subflavus either because they have the most nasty, vile secretions too, probably even worse than Timor's.
I'd never heard that before. So
they're
terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I had Puerto Ricans for a while, and I had Jamaicans for a while, and they're the most vile creatures as far as that stink that they can make. So I would never do them again. But all the power to those who can put up with it. If you like egg yolk that stinks like you've never smelled and it's really hard to get off, then that's the species for you. Oh, and not to mention Fish and Wildlife BS.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No, it's not to deal with that. Very cool. So now, you also work with Angolan pythons.
Yep.
Which, I love Angolans just because of the fact that, you know, if there's any snake out there that gets pointed at more and says that's a weird-looking ball python, it's the Angolan python. So I know Angolan enthusiasts are kind of like, ah, it's not. So, and they have those bumpy scales on their back end, which Dr. Ben Morrill was showing them off at the Arboreal Symposium, which I know doesn't really make any sense why he would bring them to an Arboreal Symposium. But anyway, what can you share with us about keeping and breeding the Angolans? Because it's not, I've heard that it's not as easy as, you know, the ball python, and they kind of get lumped into that misconception of that they're exactly like ball pythons.
No, I think they're easier than ball pythons, but that's me. They're really nothing like a ball python. They're not even, believe their closest living relative is Natalensis, which is one of the giant, you know, rock pythons, South African rock. Behaviorally, they don't. I mean, they're outgoing. They're flat and beady scales. I mean, they even have quite a bit longer tail than ball pythons. So I honestly don't even know how they ever got lumped into they're just a weird looking ball python because they get way bigger, way flatter, way more personality, and I don't think they're anything like ball pythons. I think they're easier, more willing feeders. They're just, I mean, they're great, great snakes, but they're not a ball python in any way, shape, or form. So, my experience breeding them, I think I've bred them three or four times. They breed very standard python breeding, and they seem to be very willing captives to reproduce. Their rarity in captivity in the beginning was strictly due to where they were from, and like a lot of adult wild-caught snakes, probably didn't breed the best, but once we had captive breds available, the population has expanded exponentially. And they're great captives, and if you don't want to get them because you think they're a ball python, then you need to rethink that because they're nothing like a ball python. I call them Chuck Walla pythons. They're like flat and want to get in rock cracks and then blow themselves up so you can't get them out like a Chuck Walla. So.
Oh, that would be kind of nuts if you're trying to remove them from a hide spot in their cage. Imagine that would piss me off.
Well, yeah, I had one time wedge itself between a half inch gap or an inch gap between two racks, and it just went right through there like it was built to do that. And man, it was I had a heck of a time with those beady scales trying to pull that thing out. So I ended up having to move the racks apart. But they're made to be in tight places and not to be extracted from those places.
Yeah, they never really I guess they never really did it for me, but then I seen them in person, and man, I was so wrong.
Yeah, they. I always really wanted them. I was really happy when I got them, and you know, been happy ever since. I mean, they're not like my favorite species, but they're far from my least favorite species as well.
Right.
So great snakes. I mean, really, really interactive. You know, they have a lot of personality and a very interesting feel to them when you're handling them. You can,
yeah.
When you're handling them, you can almost, if you kind of put your hand in like a C, you can feel how they'll just flatten right out and go, you know, as long as they're not. Most people keep them too round to realize how flat they should be, but they should probably look like a Gaboon viper and not a Burmese python. But,
mm-hmm. Right.
But, neat looking snake.
Cool. I was curious about your blood pythons. Do you do anything different when you're keeping them or breeding them?
I try to keep them as small as I can. It seems like the big females don't reproduce as good as the little ones.
Okay.
So I try to keep them small, so I don't feed them very often. And same thing, you got a lot of bad results with blood python breeders, and I think a lot of that is too much heat too soon. So I think the one time I had a bad blood python clutch, I had two females sitting next to each other, and I couldn't turn the one's basking spot on without turning the other one's on. And I turned the basking spot on for the one. She laid a perfect clutch, and then the other one laid a mostly bad clutch, and I believe it was just she got heat too soon and caused her to ovulate prematurely. So, I would actually say, you know, the funny thing, I've probably learned more about breeding other species from trying to breed blood pythons based on my conversations with Tracy about breeding bloods. Because at the time I got into breeding bloods, most of the people that I had seen trying to breed them got mostly slugs and very little babies. And I was still keeping stuff with basking spots like everybody else when I first got into bloods. And when she, you know, I was talking to her about it, and I was down there getting some, and she's like, oh, no, you got to keep them cool and don't feed them a lot. Try to keep them small. Only feed them when you need to. So a lot of what I do with everything was based on when I got into keeping bloods. So it's kind of funny. people argue with you, like, how could you learn about breeding green sea pythons from blood pythons? And they're surprisingly similar. If you overfeed a blood and overheat it, you're going to get a bunch of crap, and that's the same thing with green trees.
Yeah, it was funny. We were just having this conversation. Also, I was hitting on the fact that I'd like to work with some other species so that I could get a better understanding for python reproduction in general. You know, to me, it kind of seemed like if you had one species and you're kind of like working with it, you may be insulated from, like, you know, you're picking up habits, I guess, from what is...
Oh, you're completely wrecked. I fully believe that. I mean, I don't want to keep going back to the green tree python community, but the vast majority of those guys keep nothing but green tree pythons. And I think it really, really limits your ability to understand all python biology. And they tend to think green tree pythons are, like, extra special, and they, you know, they're really not. And I believe when you have lots of different species and you do your homework and you read about them and you look into them, you start noticing the common denominators to breed all pythons. And what you realize is those common denominators are really not much different for the vast majority of species out there. And if you didn't have multiple species, I think it's not that you're incapable of learning things, but what happens is you get narrow-minded focus on what your group in particular is telling people what they need to do. And when you have lots of species, you do lots of homework and you learn lots of things from lots of keepers, and you can learn. You can learn. You talk to somebody who's a great blood python breeder, and you're going to learn something about breeding all pythons. And if you talk to somebody who's a great carpet python breeder, you can learn stuff that correlates with all of them. And I definitely, wholeheartedly believe that if you're a person that keeps one thing, it's not that you're not going to learn things. It's just you're missing out on 58 species of information that's out there.
Right. I used to, where I get that from is I used to listen to reptile radio, and although those guys mainly dealt with ball pythons, you still would learn quite a bit, you know, about python reproduction and...
This will make me very unpopular, but a lot of people really piss on the backs of ball python breeders. And I guess if you don't like ball pythons, it's easy to do that. But in a lot of cases, some of the most skilled, when you're talking about breeding hundreds and hundreds and even thousands, some of these guys get thousands of clutches from ball pythons every year. Well, that, it might not be a species you like, but I can guarantee you it is a hell of a lot harder to get 50 ball python clutches, and do it right and get all good results. And then, it's just as hard doing that as it is to get 50 carpet python clutches. So these, it's easy for a guy with 6 carpet pythons to talk about how much better he is than a ball python breeder. But I would say ball pythons are at least as challenging to breed as carpet pythons. So.
Right. I could see that. Is it one of the things where, they're not really seasonal breeders, right? I mean, they're pretty much bred all year long.
Some guys do it that way. Mine all pretty much cluster breed.
Okay.
But I've got them all dialed in to do that, so it works out for me. But it's... I remember it wasn't even that long ago that ball pythons were considered impossible to breed. When I first started breeding pythons, ball pythons were rarely bred and considered extremely difficult to breed. And now that, so many people have put a lot of effort and money into learning how to breed them, it makes people think that they're not a challenging species. And I dare say, until you've done it, don't, it's easy to breed captive bred carpet pythons. It's just as easy to breed captive bred ball pythons, but they are different. And just because you can breed carpets, you might not be a very good ball python breeder and vice versa. So people with their ball python hatred need to move on and do something else than worry about what ball python breeders are doing.
I tend to agree. I've been listening to some shows on Herp Nation Radio, and the way these guys got genetics tuned in, I have to say that they're. I know the whole morph thing is kind of. I think that's what upsets everybody is they see morphs and they kind of think that they're in it for money and et cetera, et cetera. But some of these guys really nerd out, for lack of a better term, when it comes to like genetics and figuring out what's going on with those guys. So,
The vast majority of carpet python breeders, most of them breed morphs. It's not, I think if anything, I think the hatred probably more comes from the money that was asked for ball pythons and then the fact that people were paying it and it became as big as it was. It's always easy to look at the top and talk about how awful it is when you're not part of it.
Sure.
And, you trying to tell me if carpet pythons had a banana carpet that everybody would be going crazy for them? They would be.
It's easy to sit there
and talk about, I love my carpet pythons as nature intended them when you have a nice black and yellow jungle that you'd never find in the wild. So in essence, you're a morph breeder. You're just a polygenetic morph breeder instead of a, I don't see a whole lot of people with their Daintree carpets that are brown and, black talking about their great jungle carpet breeders. So.
You're saying magic to my ears, so I love it. You know, because I breed Morse, but then, you know, you'll get a lot of BS and people will say, you know, you shouldn't do that, but they're kind of creating a Morse the same way, so.
Well, I mean, I breed a Roo carp with chondras. I should be happy with whatever I produce, right?
Right.
So they're not all high white in the wild, but I want them to be high white, so that's what I'm doing. And it doesn't, you know, in essence, I'm doing a Morse breeding. It just is disguised in a more respectable manner to some.
Good point. I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole reptile business and doing it full-time as a job. And also I had some other questions in here from Rob Stone. But what do you think of the current state of the reptile hobby?
It's tougher than it used to be. You know, you've got I think the biggest thing you have is you constantly have an influx of people breeding new, you know, every year there's more guys that are breeding stuff than ever. And, you know, the other reality is everybody has nice stuff, you know, for the most part. It all came from the same place. So it's, for the most part, it's a very equal playing field. The biggest things are, you know, separating yourself as far as being a good salesperson, you know, answering your phone, shipping when you say you're going to ship, shipping professionally. I mean, I can't get over how many times I've gotten packages from people, and it's just disgusting how people ship most stuff. But it's, you know, I think there's a lot of things, little things you can do to try to separate yourself. But anymore, in a lot of cases, it seems like it comes down to just the price. And if you have the lowest price, people buy from you whether you're, you know, a stand-up person or not. But nobody really has control over that, so you just have to do what you're going to do and have a solid plan and stick with it. And it, you know, it's not for everybody. It definitely takes some of the fun away, I guess, when you have to produce.
Right.
So I've been doing it since 2005, and it, you know, some years you have a lot of money and some years you don't. And
right.
If you're not a person that's good with money, then it can be tough because your expenses are always going up, but your profit margin is always going down. So
right.
You're constantly, you know, searching for the next thing. And anymore, you're pretty much running out of the next thing. So that's like for me with ball pythons, I mean, it's still the bulk of where I make money. And I pretty much position myself to focus on double and triple recessive projects. I don't do a lot of codon stuff. And I kind of had that thought a long time ago that the stuff that's hard to do but is going to look the best is where it's at. But you go a lot of years with making relatively boring snakes to get to where you want to be. But if you're
right.
willing to put in the work, then, you know, the reward is there. So that's what I did to try to be different from every other ball python breeder. And, you know, it pays off in some regards and some things it doesn't. I didn't – there's a lot of ball python bubbles I didn't ride because I didn't have the snakes. So. but I guess that was the point. I was trying not to be in any bubble. So.
Right. Do you find that the that a double recessive project holds its value longer across the python world?
Oh, by far. Anything that's hard to make. I mean, I don't care what it is. If it's 1 in 16 odds of the snake that lays 6 to 8 eggs, you know, you're just not going to make that many of them. And so,
right.
I mean, it still depends on what it looks like. If it looks like crap, then it doesn't matter. But if it looks good and it's hard to make, then when you make it and nobody else is making it and it's really hard to do, then they either have to start the project and, you know, wait a decade to have it come to fruition, or they have to buy it from you.
There you go. Okay. So.
But I think the biggest mistake people make in breeding probably anything for a living is if you don't do what you like, then you're not going to be happy with it. And so I've told myself, if I breed the stuff I like, then for one, it should be easier to sell it because I'm going to be more passionate about it, and two, it's if I can't sell it, then I'm happy to have it. And so that's how I've approached my own breeding model, is just, you know, do the things I like, and the rest will fall into place. But
right. Well,
it's a tough racket.
Yeah. What?
Keep your day jobs, people. Keep your day jobs.
Here's a couple questions as far as we were just talking about ball pythons, and this was from Rob. But do you think that full-time breeders need ball pythons in their collection?
You know, right now the trend definitely seems the easier stuff to sell. It either has to be a really hard to make ball python, or a rare species seems to be. I mean, I couldn't get over the demand for the black white lips. But again, if you guys produce three clutches and I had a clutch and Tom Kyogen produces two clutches, then will there be that demand? I don't know.
Yeah.
So when there's only nine, there's not a lot.
0.9 in the whole country right now, captive born and bred. Yeah, it's a pretty big demand.
So it's, you know, it's like a few years ago, the first time I produced Maquillae, they sold, and they sold at a relatively decent clip. Not a lot of money, and I'm still not asking a lot of money. But this year, they're selling better than they did 2 years ago. 2 years from now, if they'll sell as good, I don't know. It's just, you know, you just have to go with it and see what happens. I think people make a big mistake trying to chase the next thing. If you have all ball pythons right now and you think you're going to go out and buy other stuff and then you're going to be a different breeder, by the time you do what you're going to do, that train could be over.
Right.
That's why I tell people, stick with what you're doing, stick with what you like, and, you know, the rest of it hopefully will fall into place. But
right.
That's
okay.
How it's been for me. I don't believe you have to have ball pythons, but it's no matter what anybody wants to believe, they're still number one, and they probably always will be. The demand is always going to be there. The price is really all your, you know, the variable of the price, but the vast majority of people that get into pythons for the first time look at all the ball python colors and combinations, and their mind starts going crazy, and they get in, you know, that mad scientist aspect you can't overlook.
Right.
And, you know, there is something to be said for these morph breedings as far as, you know, you start a project, you have a long-term goal. You know, sometimes the chase is more fun than the final thing. And with morph breeding, you get that. You always get it because you can always do something else. And with species, you know, once you've bred a Sabu python, you've bred a Sabu python. It's not going to change, you know. Nothing's
right.
Going to be different. Every time you breed it, it's going to be the exact same thing. Angolans suffer from that. Carinata is going to suffer from that. When you've seen one, you've seen them all. And I think that it makes people lose long-term interest. And I completely, utterly understand why people like morph breeding. Is it holds your attention. There's always a goal. There's always something to be doing. So,
right.
Now, do you believe it kind of ebbs and flows? Because I know that if, say, something was terribly prevalent and it was all over the place and the prices were down really, really low and people thought it maybe would be something they don't want to buy in, all of a sudden the people who are producing them stop doing the clutches, animals die, get sold, and then all of a sudden nobody's really producing that animal anymore and it becomes something rare and valuable and it goes right back up. Do you think that's something that you could be seeing too, these call them waves of up and down demand?
Oh, yeah, it happens
species.
With the species and the morphs. I've seen ball python morphs that people wanted nothing to do with, and then somebody produces something cool, and all of a sudden a morph you couldn't give away 1 year is the hottest ticket for the next 2 years. But again, that is where I get back to, do what you like, and don't, if you try to chase you know, what's the, you know, if you're chasing something, it means you're always behind.
Right.
And so if you do what you like, regardless of what, and try to not focus on what other people are doing, then you'll be much happier than if you're always chasing the quote-unquote next big thing. Because a lot of times the next big thing is not that great. What you have is better looking. I mean, I'll still tell people today that the very first ball python mutation ever produced is still better looking than 95% of the ones that have come since then. And that's, most people don't care about an albino ball, but if you took a tub of 100 mutations and handed it to a person that knew nothing about snakes, I bet you 70% of those people will think that albino ball python's cooler than anything else.
They don't know what
the price is. The price hasn't influenced their decision. All they're using is their eyes. That was what I always knew years ago with ball pythons. Was like, man, people are paying a lot of money for ugly stuff. And I never got into ugly stuff. I like pretty stuff. I mean, if I'm going to breed morphs, I want it to be orange and white and, you know, purple. And I don't want it to be just a different shade of brown. So I stuck with doing albino stuff because, for one, it was what I liked. And I thought when all the dust settled, the pretty snakes are going to be what sell. And you're starting to see that. People are, you know. The more the prices don't influence the people's buying decisions, then you'll see what is truly valuable, because people are using their eyes for their purchase, not their mind, and their their pocketbooks. So
do you think that the price will level out at some point? And
it always does. What that level out is going to be, it's hard to say. But
right.
The biggest single thing you have with snake breeders, and it's unlike, I've bred everything. I've bred parrots. I've bred, you know, rodents. I've pretty much bred all kinds of different animals. And, you know, the biggest thing the snake business faces is every animal you sell is pretty much going to become your competition. I know almost nobody that has reptile pets. Everybody breeds them. Where, like, people who buy dogs, 95-98% never breed them. In fact,
it's
frowned upon. So we have this weird deal where every baby we sell is going to be our competition, more than likely, and nobody buys these things for pets. And until you get to where the vast majority of the customers are buying it to have it as a pet, then you're basically always sitting on kind of a pyramid scheme where you need X amount of people to come in to buy X amount of animals. And when people freak out because prices are changing, then it doesn't instill confidence in the market. And then you have, you know, a lot of babies and nothing selling. So it's, you have to, and I don't know if it'll ever happen. It's hard to say if it'll ever get to where people are just buying, you know, if somebody, I mean, people go pay $1,000 for a dog and don't think anything of it, $500 to $1,000. But for whatever reason, snake people can't just buy $1,000 pet. So it's,
I wonder where that
I can't blame
that.
Them. I mean, I don't know if I would, you know, I have a hard time. People ask me all the time, like, you know, if you were going to have just one thing, it's like, I don't know if I could have just one. I don't know. And I don't know if I could not breed it. It's just part of the whole experiencing, you know, the animal for what it is and reproducing it, for me anyway.
Do you think that that has to do with the fact, like, if you have a dog, you're going to have interaction with that dog, you know, you're going to take it for a walk, you're going to play with it, it's going to meet you at the door when you come home. But when you're keeping a reptile, basically it's sitting in a cage. So really the only excitement that you're going to have, I mean, you're going to pull it out and look at it and maybe hold it, et cetera, but it's not going to be the same thing. Whereas you get that excitement from, you know, watching them breed, watching it lay eggs, maternally incubate if you go that way, and watching them hatch out. I mean, that's, for me anyway, that's been the coolest thing with keeping reptiles that I've experienced so far, is like when you see those little heads pip out of the eggs, it's like Christmas, you know?
I mean, the reproduction of these things is a huge, I mean, it's insanely interesting. The funny thing is the way mankind is moving to, you know, massive people living on top of each other in ever increasingly small areas, you would think that, you know, something that lived in a cage and didn't have to eat all the time, with the busy lifestyle that the average human being lives anymore, would become a more attractive pet. But, you know, we have a long history with our four-legged friends, and it's just a different thing. And whether reptiles can ever get to that point where people buy them just to have them as a pet, I don't know. It's hard to say.
Right.
I hope so, because I think, you know, I think that's why, you know, you have a somewhat stable corn snake market, because the vast majority of those corn snakes are getting sold to people that are just having a pet corn snake. But
right. There's
not very many people buying expensive carpet python or blood python or ball python that just, you know, are like, ooh, I just want to have this. I have done it. I've sold some expensive snake to people. They're like, ooh, I just have always wanted one of these, and now I have it, and it's their little pet, and they're happy with that. But that is by far the exception and not the rule.
Right. So true. So when it comes to doing this full-time, like, what's your preferred sales method as far as, do you go with word of mouth, Facebook, Kingsnake? What do you prefer?
For a long time, I was selling lots of stuff to wholesalers that were primarily shipping stuff overseas. So I had a flip-it mentality. I would breed it, hatch it, look at it, throw it in the box, and ship it. Now that's, you know, most of those countries now have everything that we have, so they don't have as much demand to get stuff, so I've had to switch more to a sell it to the individual myself mode. Some stuff like ball pythons sell really well at shows, better than most things, but are a little harder to sell on the internet. Rare species are easy to sell on the internet, hard to sell at shows. So I think, it depends on what you do. If you breed ball pythons, then I think you probably need to do a lot of shows. If you breed both, then you can do a lot of internet sales with one, and, stick to selling a lot of stuff at shows. The cheap, common ball pythons by far are easier to sell at shows. You're not selling lavender snows and stuff like that at shows, but
right.
You know, that's internet sales, international sales and stuff. But and the same thing, if I brought a black white lip to a show, I would probably never sell it. You know, I mean, I can think of a few people that would go to a show and buy it, but most of the time, you're not going to sell stuff like that at a show.
So, if I'm at the show, I know someone who will. So
at least not the shows around. I mean, I live in the Pacific Northwest, so there's a few shows around here, and that's it. So we don't have, like, the Daytona and Tinley and shows like that, so.
How does that impact your business being in a rural area? Like, with shipping windows and
I actually
like
think
that.
Shipping from the West Coast is nice because you ship, it's late. Like, if I ship something here at 5 o'clock, it's 8 o'clock where it's headed. You know, if it's headed to the East Coast. So
gotcha.
It seems to be like it's in less transit. And, it's not, no matter how hot it gets here during the day, it's cold at night. If it was 100 degrees here during the day, it would probably still be 70 at night. Where a lot
right.
of places, if it's 100 degrees during the day, it's 85 at night.
Right.
So, in some regards, it's nice. But, you know, the not very many shows and not a lot of, I mean, where I live, there's a handful of reptile people that I know of, but I'm somewhat reclusive. I don't, you know, invite a lot of local people to know me or know, you know. So right, it's not, it's not, there's probably quite a few more than I know, but I'm not looking for them. So it's, it, most of my reptile friends don't live around here. They don't live anywhere near me.
But, yeah.
Which has its advantages in some cases and its disadvantages in others. So.
Sure. What do you, when you're, I guess when you're doing this full time, how do you factor in, like, odds of breeding success, marketability, et cetera? Like, do you have that factored in? That you, I mean, especially when you're talking about, you know, hitting a 1 in 16 with 8 eggs and stuff like that. How do you...
You don't. You just do what you can do and see what happens. I mean, it's, and I think that's another, in some regards, it's a bad thing because what you have is, you know, you see it with carpets, you see it with balls, you see it with bloods. People are trying to make one thing, but they make, there's a lot of what I call byproduct snakes. And those snakes, you end up making a lot of the byproduct stuff for what you're after. And so you, if you have 100 people making, you know, 100 babies each, and if, let's say, 25% of those babies are the really valuable ones, well, that means 75% of what you're producing aren't that valuable. So 100 different breeders producing 75% of less valuable snakes, you know, it's, it makes it to where you have a glut of some things on the market. And most python breeders cannot... help themselves but to breed everything they have every year because they either want to produce it all or don't think they're going to produce it all, and if they do produce it all, then they got way more than they ever thought they would have. And then you end up with, you know, you see that some years there's a ton of something and then the next year there's none, and, you know,
right.
It, people can't help themselves but to put every pair they have together. And see what happens. I usually shoot for, like, with my ball pythons, I usually shoot for, I rarely breed a female back-to-back, and I probably shoot for getting 25 to 30% of my females to breed. So every spring or every fall, I look over the females, see which ones bred the year before, and I just go around and I put, green dot, green mean go. And I put a green dot on the tubs of the females I plan on trying to breed, and then I give them the lion's share of the food, and those are the females I focus on trying to breed instead of trying to breed all of them. And so that's the way I do it.
Do you find that you have more success doing it that way?
Oh, yeah. Statistically, when I used to have 10 female ball pythons, it's like you'd get 9 to 10 clutches every year. When you have 100 females, you would get, if you tried to breed them all, at least with the amount of time I can put into it, I would not get anywhere near 100 clutches.
Right.
So statistically, the more you have, the less breeding you do, in my opinion.
Right.
So at least with the time constraints I have.
You focus on the ones you want to get done, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I find if I go out and I put 25 to 30 dots on females, I usually get anywhere from 18 to 25 clutches. But if I try to breed all the females I have, then I probably wouldn't do that good.
Right. Just out of curiosity, what size collection are you working with? Are you a couple hundred or?
I think my, if you don't count babies, I probably have 150 some odd adults.
Okay.
But my collection is usually anywhere from 200 to 300 animals at any time.
Okay. And I'm assuming you breed your own rodents, right?
Yeah, I have a small mouse business where I supply the local pet stores with mice and then feed off what I need. But I do buy rats from people.
Okay.
So you're definitely, I've told people, if you want to be a rodent breeder, you shouldn't be a snake breeder because it's too hard to be good at both. And so I'm probably not near as good a mouse breeder as people who focus on breeding mice. But my focus is on breeding snakes, and I do breed mice, and I'm not the greatest mouse breeder on earth.
Right. Okay. And then let's see. I have the other question that I wanted to hit. What would be the biggest, the best tip that you could give somebody that would want to do this full time, besides keep your day job?
Well, for one, I would do it for a while, you know, and make sure that you can do it and you can consistently do it, and you're consistently good at selling the babies. Because I've known a lot of people who are good breeders and weren't very good salespeople, and I've known a lot of people who are good salespeople but lousy breeders. So it's, you know, you got to make sure you can do both, because selling snakes is an art form all into itself. And,
right.
So you know, and for years, I even avoided that for years. Like I said, I sold a lot of stuff overseas to where I just called up people and this is what I have and this is what I want, and they were out the door and I didn't have to field a million calls, and you know, but so it's all, they both have their pluses and minuses, and make sure you can consistently do it, and for two, make sure that you're good enough at selling the babies, because you can be the greatest breeder in the world and have the nicest babies, but if nobody likes you or is willing to buy from you for whatever reason, probably I'll do something else.
Right. Good point. And the last, well, before Owen comes in with his couple questions for the end, I wanted to make sure that we hit on this. But before the show, we were talking, and you had mentioned that you believe that snakes knows, that you believe the thought that the snakes knows best, is not particularly something that you buy into. Can you
hit on
that?
Well, I don't buy into it unequivocally. A lot of people think, oh, the mother snake always knows what's best. And I think the problem with that statement is everything in nature is finite and is taken away from you, whether it be food or heat. You only have X amount of feeding opportunities, and the heat, you know, is on for 12 hours a day. And it's, you know, and you got overcast days and you have sunny days, and you have all these different variables that you couldn't possibly try to mimic in captivity. And some snakes are better at, you know, self-regulating than others. But I believe some species, a lot of the species that are like avid baskers, whether it's bolani or diamond pythons, I don't think they understand too much of a good thing. Basking opportunities are limited every day, and they're not always the same every day. And so they have their program to take advantage of it when they got it. And I don't believe they have a shut-off switch necessarily. And so in captivity, if you give them that basking spot for too much time, I wholeheartedly believe that's why you have, you know, females ovulate prematurely and laying bad eggs, and because everything is sped up. Heat speeds up all the biological processes, and I don't necessarily think some of these snakes go, well, that other side of the cage is cooler. I think what they know is the sun's going to go down soon, so I better take advantage of this. And it's the same thing with food. You know, people ask me all the time with green trees, like, oh, they always act like they're hungry. And it's like, yeah, they associate you with food. So as soon as, if you walked into my snake room right now, you'd have six adult green tree pythons staring at you, wiggling their tail at you, and acting like they're starving to death. And that's just their behavior. You know, they associate me with food, so they go into hunting mode. But to me, that doesn't mean they're actually hungry. It just means they're preparing themselves for the opportunity to feed if it arises. And they're willing to eat as much as you're willing to feed them, because they just don't grasp that's too much food. I do not believe they understand that. And they have to work for their food in the wild. And that's why when I feed them the way I feed them, I make them show me how hungry they are. Because a hungry chondro is a remarkably active snake when the lights go out. And you will never see it if you don't try. If you don't force them to show you that behavior, they won't. They'll be happy to sit there on their stick, and you can hand feed them, you know, until they, you know, have a coronary embolism and drop dead, but they, I don't know if that's what kills them or not, but they're happy to let you do all the work. And,
right.
You know, look at us. Most of us are fat and overweight because we don't have to work for our food anymore.
Yeah.
So, and we have too much. You know, you're genetically programmed to want to eat as much sugary, you know, stuff like that, because when you're eating roots all the time and there's a flower, you know, like a fruit, it's like, ooh, yeah, that's great, because it's not available all the time, but how we live now, it's always available. Too much of a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, I can see that.
No different. They want to eat as much as you're willing to give them in most cases.
Hmm. Cool. Well, all right, Ryan, so we're going to get on to the interesting questions that will probably rack on your brain a little bit. First one being, what is your next reptile purchase going to be?
I know what I want. I don't know which order they'll happen in, but I would love to work with Bolani, Carinata, Dunn's pythons. So it's you know, hard to say. Hard
Dunn's
to say
python would
right.
be cool. Would that finish Liasis for you? If you got Dunn's, would that wrap up the Liasis group or?
No, I would still have to breed. I mean, obviously, I don't have Bear and I, and I don't foresee an opportunity to work with Bear and I. So,
yeah,
Liasis will be. There'll probably never be a clean sweep with Liasis. But as far as breeding the ones that are available, I would have to do olives at some point, and don't I? And then
yeah.
I guess it depends on if you believe Poplin pythons are licensed or not. I personally do not, but...
I would have to... I don't know.
Are you
if you're a DNA guy, then they should be licensed. If you're... I think DNA is a great tool, but I don't believe it's the be-all, end-all. I mean, I still think you can look and touch a snake and realize what it is. And to me, Poplin python is not licensed.
Okay.
If I had to support anything, I would probably support Bear and I and olive pythons and... Poplin's becoming a genus outside of Liasis before I would support putting Apodora in Liasis, but that's just me.
Are Dunn's pythons even available in the States?
No.
Does anybody work with them? No. Yeah.
There's a few around, but there's no...
Yeah. There was one boy up for sale, and I'm pretty sure that the amount of people that typed in Ryan's name, like on his ad on Facebook, was ridiculous. Like, I'm pretty sure you were tagged in that like 12 times. So.
Well, I thought I was going to get some Dunn's from Europe last year, but it just didn't work out. So,
that would be cool.
Deal. They're really neat. They're people think they're more like a Maculidae, but from what I've seen, they appear way more Slavolensis to me. The babies are sometimes a pinkish brown color and gray. I mean, there's like patternless ones and highly speckled ones and light gray ones and dark gray. I mean, they're really, I think there's a really, really cool species, and I really hope to work with them soon. But,
that's awesome. So if you're in Europe, send us some damn Dunn's pythons. Jesus.
We'll see. I can't blame them. You know, it's a tough racket trying to do the flighties, and you know, you got to wait all the time, and things come up. But I thought I was going to get 2.1, but just didn't work out. So such is life. You know, a lot of times, sometimes the chase is sweeter than the snake itself.
Yeah,
so
I could understand that. You get it, and you're like, all right, well, now what?
If you didn't have those goals of new things, you know, would it even be that, I don't know. For me, it's, I think a lot of this, the thing that keeps me coming back is the next species, you know? What's the next one I can breed that I haven't bred?
Oh, yeah, you got something with Erica was talking like, well, what's your next white whale? Because after you get what you've been chasing for, breed what you've been trying for, it's the next logical step is the next one. Move on.
Yep.
So
no, it's we're all addicts, I guess. We're looking for that next high.
Oh, so. Yeah.
So, mine is imbricata.
I'm no different.
Imbricata for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Albinos and diamonds are my next ones because
there you go. Diamonds would be cool. I definitely have thought that I should.
Well, that brings us to our next question. If you could own any reptile without limitations, legal or any other kind, what would it be and why?
If I could own it, or if it was the only, like, is it the only thing I can keep, or?
No. If you could own it, as in add it to your collection, and you don't have to worry about any limitations, that's price or law or anything, what would it be?
Boy, that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if I was, like, filthy rich and I could house something insanely crazy, I would definitely probably, I could see myself into crocodilians and large aquatic turtles, some of the big giant softshell turtles, and but that kind of marries a few different loves of mine. I'm deep down inside, I'm a huge Chelonian fan, and I'm also a big time, I don't keep any aquariums right now, but for many years, I was a hardcore aquarist, so I guess for me, if money wasn't an issue, laws weren't an issue, it would probably be some type of giant paludarium with crocodiles and birds. And it'd probably be a system more so than a species, I guess.
Wow. Right. That's cool.
I would have to say it would probably be a giant soft-shell turtle and a crocodilian or something like that. But Python-wise, if I could get any python, it'd probably be bear and I. But
cool.
But I could say Ontolensis, but I think bear and I is the underappreciated one. So that's probably what I'd go for.
Cool.
Well, Copan, sure. I might. If we're talking boas too, I'd probably go. It'd be cool to see a live Cro-Pan-Eye.
I stumbled upon a species of python. It's like the northern eyelash. I'm sorry, it's a species of boa. It's a northern eyelash boa. And I sent these pictures to Eric of it, and I'm like, "What the hell is this thing?" And he's like, "I have no idea, but it's badass." And I'm like, "I want that." And I find out that they're like protected. And there's none in the country. I'm like,
was it a Mona Island boa or a round island, some one of those weird.
Well, I think so. I think so. But thing looked like some sort of Chinese dragon turned to life kind of thing. So I was.
Oh, that's you're thinking of that Borneo snake. What is that thing called? The dragon snake.
No, it wasn't the dragon rat snake, but it's kind of like that because it's got the same kind of armor plating, but it's a type of boa. I'll send you pictures.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. There's a lot of little boa type things out there.
Exactly. And this is. I sent this picture to some of my friends who breed boas. They're like, "What the hell is that?" So I'm like, "Oh yeah, I already knew it was something that I was never going to be able to look at or even touch." But
yeah,
it was
the only
cool
boas
to dream.
I have are I just have a pair of basin emeralds from the babies that I produced last year. That's the only boas I keep right now.
Gee, the only ones I have are Amazon trees, and they're nasty.
Those are cool.
So,
I used to have some. I really like them. It's just, it always boils down to how many tubs do I have or how many cages do I have, and it seems like, I've had Amazons a few times, and it always seems to boil down to, I'd rather keep a few more green tree pythons. So. They seem to lean out, but I wish I could, I wish I had unlimited time and unlimited space, and I'd probably have a big Corallis collection. But
yeah.
One of us
when
needs to hit the lottery.
When it comes down to it, I'll keep my pythons. So. You always got to make those hard decisions, what you got time for and what you can keep.
Mm-hmm. That is
that's
the hard part.
That's why I don't have poplins. Or...
yeah.
That's
I drew
cool
the line at something.
That is a really cool python, is a poplin python.
Oh, heck yeah.
So we keep hearing about from people who keep them. So.
No, man, they're insanely cool. I have a pair that I kept till they were, I don't know, probably 8 feet or 7.5 feet or something. I don't know, long, skinny, but they're just, that's a...
Anything that eats scrub pythons, anything that can eat scrub pythons is pretty badass in my book.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, scrub. I don't care what anybody says, man. You put a poplin python into the scrub python, that scrub python doesn't stand a chance. Not on its best day. That poplin's going to whoop its ass every time.
Wow.
Jeez. There's just something about those things, man. They're just, they're different.
They're like the king cobra of the python world, you know?
They
kind of are. They really kind of are. I mean, in power, they're just insanely strong for their size. Big, huge forked tongue. Way deeper forked than most pythons. Just really deep forked tongue. And that bulldog head and their personality and the color changeability, just bad, bad snakes, man. Very cool.
Awesome.
Man, you're making me want to go get poplin pythons.
See how this happens? Imagine how we feel.
I know, right?
Oh,
this is why my collection has expanded since I started doing the show with Eric. You used to have nothing but coastals, and now I got freaking tons of shit. But anyway, next question is, if you could travel to any place in the world without limitations, where would you go?
Again, probably a homer. I'd go to Australia. I guess I would probably, if I had to take all the world's pythons over Australian pythons, I would probably take the world, but as far as going to look for pythons, I would probably enjoy going to Australia the most. So, Australia, probably, I think I would probably want to do 3 trips, go to the rainforest, go to the center, and then go to the west coast and the Kimberley. So, someday.
Very cool.
Someday. Be pretty fun.
Very
to see
cool.
Green python in the wild.
All right. So, would you be a reptile show attendee or a vendor?
The last time I went to a reptile show as an attendee was probably 10 years ago. So I would have to say a vendor.
If I go,
I'm
vendor. What you are. All right. And how can people get in touch with you if they're going to try to get one of your fantastic pythons from you?
You can look me up on Facebook. Hopefully, before long, I'll have a website. I own the domain and everything, but the site's not up. So it will be molecularreptile.com. But like I said, it's currently under construction. And you can call me 208-964-2308 or email me ryreptiles@gmail.com. So pretty easy to get a hold of if you want to.
Cool.
Well, we appreciate you coming on and chatting with us. And man, we could probably do a round two with all the stuff we didn't hit on that you have and keep and welcome back anytime and
no problem and congratulations with your guys' venture with ProExotic.
Thanks.
Well, and I hope you your python breeding ventures go well.
Thank you and
appreciate that.
For you continued success because if you're doing it, and gives me something to shoot for. So.
Well, there you go. I hope so. I got to feed the kids. So.
Yeah.
There you go. So.
I appreciate it, guys.
All right.
Thank
Ryan.
You very much, Ryan.
All right.
Have
take
a good
care.
Day.
Good night.
Bye.
That was a cool show, man. That was really cool.
Full of, like, you know how we, like, we have a show of, like, Liasis, and we have a show of, like, Green Tree, and we have a show of, like, other craziness? It's really cool to have somebody who's got his hands in so many different things and is very knowledgeable, and then on top of that, also successful with some of the rarest species on the planet. And, you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, I'm like, oh, I got the Amazon. He's like, oh, I did those. I have that. I've had that. I've had this. I've had that.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's not like I had that, got bored with it, got rid of it. I had that, loved it, appreciated it, probably was successful breeding it, but then it came down to I need cage space. Sorry, guys. So it's almost like people like Ryan, if they had unlimited funds and a warehouse, they'd have every single species on the planet. So,
right.
And that's what's cool.
Yeah.
So.
You know, it's weird that, I don't know if this is just the way it worked out or whatnot, but one of the things that I like about Ryan and always respected about him is the fact that he worked with so many different types of species of python, similar to Nick,
mm-hmm.
you know, same type of thing.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate those type of guys. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, like, you know, man, these guys really understand what's going on and they have a breakdown. And, you know, me and you were talking about it and I was saying – this is a couple weeks back, that I think that just working with carpet pythons and Morelia is kind of like keeping me, you know, close-minded, so to speak. And, you know, I guess you don't suffer from the same thing because you're working with, you know, a multitude of different species. So I was thinking about it, going back and forth. Do I get with this? Do I get that? Da-da-da. You know, and I'm thinking, man, what an idiot. Why don't you just get pythons? That's what you love. I always love pythons. Pythons are what do it for me. I just really dig them.
You're easing into it. You're trying to soften the blow for the people. So
what's that?
I'm just going to jump. I'm going to jump.
Well, no. Hold on. So, you know,
Go on.
So as I'm sitting there and I was talking to you on our way up, I was talking to you and saying about, and I've talked with Zach and Dave about this as well, but,
right.
You know, I thought if you're going to do this full time or if you're going to, you know, if you're going to, you know, try to at least shoot for it to do it full time, then, you know, you have to have a variety of types of species. And you've shown this just going to shows and having different stuff on your table. So we're at Hamburg, and it's funny. I go down, and I'm talking to Matt Minatola, and we worked out.
A guest of the show, yeah.
Yeah. So I've always wanted one of his Borneos, because I think he just breeds fantastic Borneo short tails.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked out a deal, and he ended up – I ended up getting a female short tail, and it was a 2013. So I had her at the table, and Jason comes over, and, you know, we're just shooting the shit or whatever, and he said, oh, man, you must have been reading your mind. So we got into this big conversation about just having different stuff on the table. He was talking about Walma pythons and how he has Walma pythons on the table, and every time that they sell, you know, meanwhile, you have some of the most stunning super caramel jaguars, and people are just walking by, you know, and it's kind of like...
Exactly, and he had a project of, I forget what colubrid, but he's actually dusting it off because he hasn't been breeding in the past couple of years, but now he's redoing it because he wants to have more things on the table. He picked up a female Timor python when we were at Hamburg because he has a male now because he's doing that. So Balin is understanding that more stuff, like I've said it before, if you have a variety of stuff on your table, you can appeal to a larger crowd. Limiting yourself to one species on the table or even just one type is what's going to kill you. I mean, the good thing about carpet python was that you could have, or is still, that you can have coastal jungle thyrian jays and everything else under the sun that's in carpet python or Morelia and still have a variety, because you have people walk up and be like, you have a jungle. And if I don't have a jungle, then I got to turn away. I might have carpet python, but not the one they're looking for. But having other things like, you know, the show on Saturday, I think I sold one caramel carpet and then two baby corn snakes. So
right.
having those baby corn snakes there is what really kind of helped pay for the table and a few other things. So,
yeah, I mean, I think
correct. We've had that conversation that more variety equals more sales equals more people coming back later. So
I think that, you know, like one of the things that we were talking about, at least this is my opinion, is that sometimes if you can offer, you know, it seems like a lot of people are working with the same type of stuff. You know, it's just like Ryan was saying earlier, you're kind of like you're selling to your competition, and they're going to one day go ahead and breed, for the most part, going to turn around and breed, and they're going to be your competition. But I truly believe, and maybe this is just from my daytime job, is that what sets you apart is your customer service, how you treat the customer, your interaction, your their ability to rely on you for your knowledge as far as care goes, and et cetera, et cetera. So if you can get somebody on a species maybe to introduce them into the world of pythons, then maybe you can allow them to graduate up. So anyway, long story short, I go back down. I was talking to Matt again, and he had some ball pythons on his table that he was looking to move. Now, we were talking earlier, and, you know, I was saying, do you think that that's something that, you know, you would need to get into, or you would, you know, want to get into? And one of the things that, for me personally, it wasn't so much about having it for the table. It kind of echoes what Ryan was saying earlier. You know, it's easy to come on here every Tuesday and talk a lot of shit about, you know, that's easy to breed, da-da-da-da-da, but I never did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really talk any shit because I don't have a leg to stand on. So I decided that I was going to pick up a ball python to get in a project.
Yes.
And to... you know, to experience it. My thing is that I really want to be able to say that I have bred as many different python species as possible. And I was curious to see the difference between a carpet python maternal incubation and a ball python maternal incubation. So, you know, I guess...
It also makes sense for what you're trying to do, because something else that was said to me is that you can breed everything under the sun, but if you rely on your sales at shows and online, you want to appeal to everybody, and if something as popular as ball pythons, you would need to address it somehow, even if it's just picking up a pair of albinos and breeding them and selling the babies. It would be sales that you could potentially lose, especially with ball python being a very popular python as a pet. So even if you were just to get a trio of het albinos, breed them, sell the normal babies for this much and the albino babies for this much, you could have something you could offer for the people who are looking for that. And it might work out. You might get some sales, you might not get some sales. But the important thing is that the whole point is that you're not going to get the sales if you don't have the product on the table. So are you going to get as many ball python sales as the guy who strictly does ball pythons and has been doing it for 10 years? No. But are you going to get one or two ball python sales that'll make the day worthwhile, pay for the table for the next show, or pay for your lunch that day? Yeah. But if you don't have ball pythons at the table, you're not going to get the ball python sale. So that's the meat of it. If you want the sales, get the product.
You know, there's a type of, I guess it's nostalgia or whatever for me personally, because when I was just getting back into reptiles back in the early 2000s, you know, an albino ball python was 40-50 grand. You know, I mean, you're talking like a huge a price tag that's unattainable for somebody that's just getting in. So, I mean, and one snake that always blew my mind, as much as, you know, we would never talk about it on the show or anything like that, would be an albino pied. So, I mean, like I said, I'm just looking to do a project just to have fun with it. But it's weird that as he was talking about it, he was talking about recessive. For me personally, codominant projects seem to me like something that I wouldn't be interested in. But I really dig on the recessive stuff. So,
well,
long story short.
Well, codon projects fall from the sky. You get one male who can breed to a whole rack of females. So codon projects are normally the ones that just go through free fall. I mean, with recessives, you're going to have to get it, raise heads, breed heads, get visuals, breed visuals. It's one of the things that a lot of times where recessives go downhill or when people turn loose to 100% heads for really, really cheap just to burn them off.
Right.
If you put a value on the heads that is almost as equal to the visuals or sell them as pairs, you can retain the value of the recessive longer because it takes people longer to raise them up. So, yeah, that's where you get it.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that I was thinking about, too, and this is something else that we talked about, was the fact that, you know, it seems like, I mean, me and you, we're local. We're pretty much in the same territory and, you know.
If I had a Nerf gun, I could hit your house.
Yeah, don't hit me with a wet paper towel. But if we were, and it seems to me like if I do a show, usually me and you are splitting a table at some point. So I started to think about it, and I was like, you know what would probably make sense if that we're going to be splitting a table and Owen has these species of python, it would probably make sense to have these species of python to work with first. You know, that way we're not like kind of competing with each other, so to speak.
Well, now is the time that I announce the merger of Rogue Reptiles and EB Morelia, but really you just become Rogue Reptiles Site C. So congratulations. You'll be getting your plaque in the mail as well as the Rogue Reptiles t-shirt. I suspect everything EB Morelia to be burned in your backyard.
Yeah. But, I mean, seriously, but that's kind of like the way I looked at it. So it's like you're doing these types.
Well, it makes the most sense because, you know, if we were selling the same stuff and we were splitting tables and you always sold and I didn't, I'd be kind of pissed. But, you know, it's better that way because then I'm like, well,
vice versa.
I don't offer that. So it's okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, like the projects that you're doing is different than the projects that I would be doing, which, you know, to me, it just kind of I'm not doing it. I will work with, you know, pythons that you work with, but it's just right now at this point, you know, and I also look at it this way, and I am being a little selfish and you'll probably agree with this. If I have a pair of say, ring pythons that breed, and you have a pair of white lips that breed, I'm sure that we can say, well, here you go.
Of course. Yeah.
And I'll say,
You don't even need to finish. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, well, I would like two of those, and then here are two of these, and then move on. Yeah.
Right.
Of course, these are the perks of being a co-host. There aren't that many, but there are perks somewhere.
So, yeah, I mean, that was the Hamburg experience. And it's just weird that it coincides with, you know, with us talking to Ryan tonight. And I had no inclination that that's, you know, what he was going to say or whatever. But I kind of...
Almost like we planned it, but we swear we didn't. We're not that good.
Yeah. So, there you go. I guess now that, you know, I'll probably get... tons of, you know, I'm not selling my carpets. I'm not getting out of carpets.
Yep.
Carpets are my love. They always will be. You know, it's just, I'm
looking to see if the albino ball python is compatible with his albino jag carpet python.
Oh, hell no. Come on.
So, you know, he's going to make the albino carpal. And, you know, I think at that point, I remove your Morelia Breeders Club card and tear it in front of you.
Yeah.
Do we have those yet? No, all right. Never mind. But
they'll be in the mail. But
it was almost as good as the Battle Chondro. Almost as good.
Yeah. Not quite.
But almost
probably,
as good.
Probably my favorite. Let's
Chondro people would kill me. Oh, my God. Be done.
Yeah. let's run down the list and get the heck out of here. But
wrap it up.
Next week, I will not be here. I actually am going on a pretty cool trip. I'm headed down to Florida to see my in-laws, but on the way down, I'm stopping at the St. Augustine Crocodile.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, hell yeah. And then we're taking a trip up to the Everglades midweek to do something.
Wow.
With so, yeah,
that's
it should be
cool.
A good time.
I did see the picture your wife posted where, like, she's packed and you just have an empty suitcase.
Yeah, what the hell do you need when you're going to
I don't know. That she, like, you know, so you're like, we're going to leave until Sunday. I'm like, all right. So, you know, maybe she was just a little overzealous with this. I wouldn't pack that early either. So, yeah, I can't blame you anymore.
Yeah. So,
don't
but,
call
her no, I won't. Yeah. For some reason, she's obsessed with packing like I'm obsessed with pythons, but
right.
So be it.
Okay.
So
you will not be here, so it will fall on to me to run the radio show yet again.
Yes, yes.
Ah, crap.
And
well,
we're not really sure what is going to happen, but...
Well, actually, so far what we have right now, as I've confirmed... Chris is going to come by, so it will be another Rogue Reptiles takeover of Morelia Python Radio. So we're probably going to do a round table if I can think of somebody else to come on with me and Chris, and we'll review some topics, talk of some things, talk about the big thing running around out there is right now is partnerships with other breeders. So Chris and I coming from an actual partnership would probably be one of the main topics we'll talk about.
I would be very. I would look forward to hearing that show. So
you can, because you are now a viewer. So
yes. So and then the week after that, which would be July 1st, I believe. Just make sure. Yep, July 1st. That will be the launch of the Reptile Insider segment. Where Chad and Robin will from Ship Your Reptiles, the Reptile Report, and the Reptile Marketplace will be stopping by. And I'm not sure of the topic that we'll be talking on, but we will be hitting on the topic at the beginning of the show. And then, you know, I don't know where the ghost, the who the guest at that point will be. I'm trying to probably maybe keep it open if those guys want to stretch out a bit and talk with us.
Right.
Then I got some cool guests lined up for July, but no confirmation yet. Oh, yeah, we do have David Kelly from Kelly Herpetoculture will be coming by on the following week after that. We'll be picking his brain on some diamond pythons. So you're ready to take the diamond python leap. I don't know a guy who's more passionate about diamond pythons besides maybe Josh Easter and, yeah, I don't know. So.
Okay. Well.
Good deal.
So, yeah, whatever. that sounds cool, so we'll get to do that kind of stuff. Be cool. Potential. God. All right. But that sounds cool, so we can definitely do those kind. We'll see how July rolls up. We always have a good month, I believe, and we're inching ever closer to the third anniversary. So, I mean, I'm still planted in my head as something that's coming up quick. So.
Yes. We'll be there before you know it. So, I'll run down a list, and we'll get the heck out of here. So the
all
forum,
right.
Check out the forum, www.moreliapythons.com. You can check out our website at www.moreliapythonradio.com. If you want to email us, if you have questions or comments, please feel free to drop us a line at info@moreliapythonradio.com. If you missed the show, you don't get to listen to it live, you can always download it on iTunes, or you can check it. I have it posted up on MoreliaPythonRadio.com on the next day. We still have that booster going on. I forgot to mention that.
We do. You guys are doing freaking great, though. I mean, the booster itself, last time I checked on it, and I'm going to pull it up real quick, we were, I believe, 45 shirts away, sold, which we set the goal to be 50 because I honestly didn't believe you guys anymore because we've been setting the goal steadily slower, and we've been getting pretty close. But, yeah, so far we have 45 shirts sold with a goal of 50. Now, we can exceed the number 50. We don't have, it does not stop at 50. We can definitely go over that. So if you have not bought your shirt yet, please go purchase it. It's they're $20 a shirt. They did redo the logo a little bit with the color scheme. They called me saying it was going to cost too much, but it still looks badass and still a great picture and still a great cause. Currently, right now, we have raised $869 to send Ari for help him out with his research, paying for something, which is awesome. But I want more. I want us to get us to the 50, and I would love to get us over 50. If you are overseas and you want to get this shirt, drop a line to either me or Eric. You can go on to the booster site and you purchase the shirt using your own debit card, credit card, PayPal, whatever you want to do. Buy it with your name, but then you're going to ship it as a shipping address. You're going to use either my home or Eric's house, and then we will talk to you about sending it out to you. We've been normally charging $15 flat for international shipments. They usually come in at about between $12 and $15 to ship out to you guys overseas, depending on where you are. So we figured $15 flat rate is fine. So get in contact with us. Let us know, and we'll get you squared away. But, yeah, good work, guys.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, if you haven't gotten it, get over there and get it, because before you know it, it'll be gone.
Limited time,
kicking yourself. That's right. I guess I will throw this out, too, real quick, for our buddy, Mr. Behoff. He's still offering that 40% off through Ship Your Reptiles. Use the code CBR40 and get 40% off of your 40% off discount using Ship Your Reptiles. And what else do I have? For myself, ebmorelia.com. We have, like we said at the beginning of the show, I'm waiting on a clutch, actually three clutches. I have a albino jag to a zebra head albino. I'm hoping for some albino zebra jags. And I have a albino jag to a caramel head albino, again, waiting for some caramel albino caramel jags, which will be pretty cool. And I have my last clutch of the year for me is citrus tiger het albino. So that should be pretty cool. That's what I got. So if you're interested in that stuff, I don't know what I'll be holding on to or what I won't be. But I'm sure that if you're interested in anything, feel free to drop me an email at eric@ebmorelia.com, and I can put you on a list if you're interested. And then go give our Facebook page a like. It's just EB Morelia. And I'm always trying to post pictures up there of what we have going on. I try to do that daily as much as I can. So, you know, if you're interested in what we have, go over there and check it out. And that's all I got.
All right. What I got is you can go to rogue-reptiles.com, check out all the cool stuff we got going on over there. I'm updating it as we go, putting up babies for sale. If you go to Rogue's Facebook page, we have the current babies for sale. A lot of ones from last year. I'll be posting up the 2014 Super Caramels very soon. Once I decide to do that, we've got the pictures and the prices, but not up yet. I don't know why I'm stalling and just haven't done it. So look out for that. Also, we posted them up on the Kingsnake. Like I said, if you are a member of the Facebook page, you get to see all our ads before they get to the public for a week. So if you're looking for a baby, that would be the place to start. With that, I will say good night, and we will see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of ProExotics. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship your reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.